You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me a good friend, John Rubino, as my guest in the second half of today's show. Thanks for joining me again, John.
Oh, sure, Jay. Good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, and it's good to tell our listeners that your website is dollarcollapse.com, dollarcollapse.com, and a lot of very interesting titles and articles that you've posted there. That I want to get into today as we talk about the subject about stagflation. Could we be facing stagflation as we did in the 1970s? I believe you're old enough to remember the 1970s. John, maybe you were in kindergarten or something. I don't know.
I was in college.
Oh, I don't think you're that old. Anyway. Were you in college then? Okay.
I was. And you know what? The 1970s was actually a really formative experience for me because I thought it was a philosophy major in college. But I picked up a book by a guy named Harry Brown, who was a libertarian philosopher.
Oh, absolutely.
And also, yeah,
sure.
He was a gold bug investment advisor. So I was paying attention to gold when gold went to $850 an ounce from, what was it, 35 to start, and silver went from a couple of bucks to 50 bucks an ounce. So my first financial bubble was thanks to, that experience reading a philosophy book. And the bubbles have continued ever since. So that was a really good piece of early education.
Yeah, I guess you are among a declining number of people that were alive when we still had a quasi gold standard then. You were alive then. I mean, as a young guy. I mean, 1971, I remember very well reading the New York Times on August 16th, I think it was, riding from Morristown, New Jersey into Manhattan for some reason that day, and reading all about Nixon's temporary closing of the gold window temporarily. Of course, it's temporary. I guess if you're looking at, infinite amounts of time, it's still temporary, but it's, 1971, a few years later. So you remember then very well, John, the stagflation days of the 1970s when we had a very weak economy, a lot of unemployment, and rising prices. It seems like the two shouldn't go together, but they did, right?
They did. And this has the feel of an early version of that, because back in the 1970s, growth was lackluster, but the government was creating a lot of new currency to try to finance the Great Society social programs and the Vietnam War at the same time.
Right.
And to manage the energy shocks of the 1970s. So inflation, in a way that people could understand, gas prices, food prices, things like that, they were going up dramatically. And people began to lose faith in the dollar. So we had inflation hitting double-digit levels, and then everybody moving their capital out of things like fixed income, which were just in a monstrous bear market in the 1970s, and into inflation hedges like gold and silver, and to an extent, real estate. And the reason for that is because it looked like the dollar was going to just evaporate because of government mismanagement. Now, that actually turned out to be kind of illusory. The government wasn't actually mismanaging its finances as badly as we thought it was back then, which makes today even more interesting because we're starting to see the early stages of stagflation, as you said. Mm-hmm. But the government actually is mismanaging its finances now. It's borrowing insane amounts of money and creating other obligations via underfunded liabilities and things like that. And it's encouraging the private sector to borrow record amounts of money at pretty much every level, And so we have a legitimate currency crisis coming based on the actions of the U.S. government and the Japanese government and the Chinese government and the EU governments, because they're all mismanaging their economies in the same way. So it'll be interesting to see if we have a repeat of the 1970s or something much more serious, because it's real this time. Back then it was just a trial run for the true currency collapse that was inevitable after we went to pure fiat currencies. And now we're heading into the part of the cycle when that might be an actual reality. So this gets very interesting very soon, I think.
Yeah, well, certainly the 1970s is when we, I think it was Nixon that said, we're all Keynesians now. And so the whole idea of free market economics, leaving the government out of and not trying to interfere with the natural flows of supply and demand and capital, you know, and timing of capital, which is really what the Keynesians have done, is disrupted the time preference, I think, of capital, right? And have, as David Stockman says, really not allowing, how can you have capitalism when you're not allowing capital to be priced, price recognition for capital? But John, you know, in the 70s, I think it was James Dines, I remember pointing out one time that in fact, the 1970s, when you took into account inflation, that they were just as devastating to equity holders as the 1930s were, because we had, you know, your stock market goes down a lot. It went down a lot in the 70s, as I recall. But, you know, when you factor in high levels of inflation and the purchasing power from those sale of those stocks was drastically in decline. Now we have, of course, if you look at the stock market, we've had this huge bull market that just seems to go on forever. Since 2008, 2009, we've had this massive bull market in stocks. And yet, if you look at stocks, of course, looking at inflation, they're not nearly as good. Actually, I think I saw stocks priced in gold, and they're not nearly as impressive as they are just looking at the dollar value. But do you think, I mean, it leads me, the next question I had for you is, what do you think about the, you know, it seems like the stock market, you know, like right now, little people get into the stock market towards the end. They're finally convinced that there's no danger, that it only goes up forever. What is it that causes people to be so surprised? And all of a sudden, people are surprised when the market heads down. There was an article on your website rationalizing those peak cycle numbers. Investors are unconcerned about record corporate debt. Talk to us a little bit about what are some of the rationalizations that people make or that are being made now, perhaps, to justify an equity market that is very, very long in the tooth and overvalued by many metrics?
Yeah, well, one aspect of this is that people have fairly short memories or no memories at all. You know, if a bull market goes on for 8 or 9 years, like this one mm-hmm. has, you have a whole generation of people in the markets now who have never seen a bear market. They've never known a time when stocks and bonds didn't go up. So it's really easy for them to just assume that that's the reality and that they're always going to go up. So buy them at any price because they're always going to go up. If you know, if you overpay a little bit now, they'll go up enough to make it work out for you in the long run anyhow. The other thing that that happens at the peak of cycles is that the investment community wants to keep the ball rolling. So sure. They come out with a lot of explanations for why it's happening or for why it's different this time.
Yeah.
That rationalizes stuff that that really shouldn't be rationalized. But, you know, people who aren't finance experts, who don't spend all their days obsessing about this stuff, like you and I do, Jay.
Yeah,
it's really easy to fool them. If you're a stockbroker and you say, you know what, Amazon is taking over the world. They're going to grow by 30% a year for the next 10 years. So don't worry about what you pay for them now. Mm-hmm. People believe that, especially since it's been going up for such a long time. You know, it's easy to fool people at the very peak, which is why you see a changing of the guard in terms of who's buying stocks towards the end of a cycle. The institutional money starts to flow out. In other words, the guys who've seen a few business cycles start taking their profits, and retail money starts flowing in, which is almost the ultimate dumb money. You know, just regular guys who you know, aren't experts in this kind of thing, but they see things going up and they get excited, and so they shift their IRA completely to growth stocks or whatever, right at the peak. And you know, that's sad that happens, but it does happen every single time. But I will say that this time around, retail investors aren't the dumbest money, because we've got corporations buying back record amounts of their own stock at record high prices, and governments around the world now buying equities almost randomly. You know, they don't even do security analysis. They just buy the S&P 500 or whatever.
Sure.
So they're even dumber than regular people who maybe actually try to figure out whether something is a good buy.
I wonder if they're dumb or if they're just con artists, because frankly, I think a lot of times stocks are being bought back by the managements of these companies with cheap money, of course, because the interest rates are still so very, very low. And then they jack up the stock price in order to perhaps to exercise their options, huh?
Yeah, okay, that's true. When we're talking about dumb corporate money, we have to differentiate between the executives,
right,
who might know what they're doing. Yeah, they intend to retire rich and leave the mess for their successors. And and then the corporation, on the other hand, which is an entity with a long lifespan that goes on, that's an extremely dumb entity in terms of buying back its own stock, because it's got people, you know, it's like a person with some really bad impulses. You know, if you've got some neuroses, they lead you to do dumb things, you know, and that's kind of what a corporation is. It's got these executives that aren't out for the benefit of shareholders. They want to pump up the stock price in the short run, get their massive year-end bonuses, cash out their stock options, and then retire, you know, at the age of 67 with millions of dollars and a well-functioning company that's going to have trouble later, but their successor will be blamed for that trouble, you know, and that's their plan, and it's working beautifully for these guys lately.
Right. I would say also the governments, perhaps, to get past the next election as well. So it's kind of like the fox that's guarding the chicken coop, I'd say, perhaps.
Yes.
But anyway.
Yeah. And Jay, you know what it all comes back to is that we gave these guys unlimited printing presses in 1971.
Yeah. So that's the key.
Yes. We activated the worst impulse of the political and corporate class, and we gave them basically an unlimited credit card.
Well, that has worked for the United States in large part, and I don't know that we have time to get onto this subject, but certainly the United States has benefited from having the world's reserve currency. 1971, when we went off the gold standard, meant that other countries then didn't have the same advantage. Otherwise, it was a sort of a level playing field for everybody. And now, because the United States has its military, its power, it's able to force people to use the dollar and so on and so forth. And I know we've had some discussions with David Jensen and others on this show about what's going on in China now, the 26th of March, coming up next week, I guess, another week or so here, that we'll start to, they're going to start to officially, China is going to officially start paying for its oil in yuan, and then there is the opportunity for countries that may not want to hold yuan to hedge in the gold exchange in Shanghai. Have you given any thought to that, John, just briefly? Maybe you could comment on that. Is that something you think might be important in terms of looking at the dollar's purchasing power? Because in the end, if the dollar loses its value vis-a-vis the rest of the world's currencies, then that's going to change everything for us, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, this might be very important. But to put it in context, as you said, we had this huge advantage with the world's reserve currency, and we exploited it. You know, we abused our privilege since basically the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, and onward to today. And a lot of the rest of the world is mad at us because of that, with good reason, you know? And so China and Russia, and to a lesser extent Europe, would like to get back a little bit of the power that they see us having and not deserving. Mm-hmm. So you see a lot of bilateral trade deals out there now where people bypass the dollar, or countries bypass the dollar in their trade with each other. To the extent that spreads, these countries don't need as many dollars as reserve assets anymore, because part of reserve assets is to facilitate trade. You know, so they've got to buy some of their bilateral trading partners' currencies and hold them in reserve at the expense of dollars. So you will see the sale of dollar-denominated bonds by China and Japan and to an extent Europe and to an extent Saudi Arabia going forward, if this plays out the way it could play out. Mm-hmm. And that puts downward pressure on the dollar, which could easily snowball. When a currency starts to fall and the government that's managing the currency doesn't have any good tools for arresting that fall, then you've got Venezuela. Soon to be Argentina, maybe, but Venezuela today.
No, let's hope not.
Yeah. And And, you know, we're heading for a big superpower version of that at some point in the future, where our currency is so mismanaged that the world loses faith in it. But of course, all the other fiat currencies are in such bad shape too that, you know, relatively speaking, we don't look so bad right now. But it's really a race to the bottom with the euro and the yen and the yuan and the dollar. So the question for the future kind of becomes, you know, who gets there first and, you know, what's the relative order? But there isn't a question that these currencies are all headed downward, because all the governments are making the same mistakes. They're all taking on too much debt. They're all creating too much currency. They've all pushed interest rates down to artificially low levels. They're all, as you said, warping the price signaling mechanism of the markets by manipulating them for public policy goals. So that can't lead anywhere but to a loss of faith in these fiat currencies. So it's more of a question of timing. You know, when does this blow up, yeah, rather than if it blows up?
Yeah. Well, a very interesting article at dollarcollapse.com titled, "Now We Know How Far Stocks Have to Fall for the Fed to Act." Stocks start to fall, as David Stockman has talked about, the hissy fit that the market throws as soon as it doesn't like rising interest rates. And then the Fed has, you know, at least under Janet Yellen and Bernanke, has recanted or relented and has turned around and started pumping money into the system. And I have to think that, you know, going back to the 70s again, one of the things, reasons that Volcker raised interest rates was because the rest of the world was saying, we don't want your dollars anymore. You're just inflating them, and they're becoming increasingly worthless. So Volcker had to raise interest rates, or allow interest rates to rise as he took money out of the system. So what about this article on your, maybe you could talk a little bit about what is sort of a key area or a key point in which Jerome Powell, the new Fed chairman, might start to relent and start to, you know, stop his tightening process? Because as I understand, I mean, David Stockman told us a couple of weeks ago that he expects 4 rate rises this year, at least 4. So what are your thoughts on that, and what are some of the people saying in the market? And your dollarcollapse.com, the article is there. I would encourage people to go there to read that article and many others that are very, very important and insightful articles. But tell us about that, John.
Well, it looks like it's about 10% on the stock market. When you have a correction in the S&P 500 or the Dow, mm-hmm, the Fed sends out its talking heads, first of all, to start calming everybody down. And they say, yeah, oh, you know, maybe we'll slow down the pace of interest rates. Or, you know, what they did this last time was they said, you know what, that 2% inflation target, that's just that's a suggestion. We could go to 3 or 4% if we need to, you know. Uh-huh. And the idea was that money will be easier in the future than the market is afraid that it will be. Mm-hmm. Now, that's phase one. If stocks keep dropping from there, let's say we have a 20% drop in stock prices, which is the official definition of a bear market, then you'll see other things happen. The Fed will maybe even say, okay, never mind about interest rate increases from now on. We've raised enough. That'll do it. And if that still doesn't work, then it's QE to infinity again. They will come back out and start buying every kind of asset imaginable. And they'll cut interest rates to zero and beyond. And that's really what happens in the next recession, okay, which has to come. I mean, we're 9 years into a recovery, which makes this one of the longest recoveries ever. So we got a recession out there just in the normal course of the business cycle. When it happens, the Fed will drop this whole pretense of raising rates and trying to normalize monetary policy. They will go back to QE, but much more extreme than what we had in the past. And they'll start buying equities, and they'll buy junk bonds, and you name it, they'll buy it with newly created currency. That's, I think, when everything blows up, you know, because who wants the currency of a country who's doing something like that?
John, with just a couple of minutes left here yet, a couple of other articles on your site at dollarcollapse.com. Yield curve turns threatening again. And another one was yet another chart that screams look out, and that second one had to do with debt default rates, I think. Talk to us about some of these things that investors should keep an eye on for maybe a key to a tipping point. What are some of the things you're seeing? Yield curve, for example, or debt default spreads.
Yeah, basically all the indicators that in the past reached points that preceded crises are at those points again. You know, so anything you look at is screaming recession imminent. You know, and for instance, the yield curve. That's the difference in yield between long-term debt and short-term debt. And in a healthy economy, long-term debt yields more than short-term debt. In an economy that's tipping over into a recession, getting ready to slow down, that line flattens out. So the short-term debt and long-term debt yield pretty much the same thing. Well, we're heading for that again. The long-term yield on say, 10-year Treasury bonds is rising, but it's rising more slowly than short-term yields. And the yield curve is flattening out. Now, that's a sign that a recession is coming. It's been a pretty good indicator over the years, and we're headed back there. We're not quite at the trigger point, but another few months, like the last few months, and we're there. You know, and the junk bond default rate is incredibly low, even as huge amounts of debt is being taken on in the corporate sector. When junk default rates reach a certain point, that's also usually a sign that they're going to turn around, you know, because there has to be a background level of default rates within the junk sector. And when you hit that, that tends to indicate that money is so easy that it can't stay this easy for very much longer.
All right.
And then,
John, we're going to have to leave it go at that. I guess what investors should do then, right now, in 10 seconds?
Oh, be careful. Things are getting unstable, and you want to protect yourself as best you can.
All right. We'll have to leave a go at that. Gold and cash and stay out of debt, I guess. Those are the big ones. So anyway, John, my apologies. I just realized that we're running out of time here. So thanks very much for being with us, folks. That is all the time we have. Next week, Charles Hugh Smith will be with me to talk about international trade. And hopefully we'll also have Michael Oliver with us again. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.